McCain advisor Phil Graham, with a doctorate in economics, says we're in a mental recession and a nation of whiners. But John McCain isn't buying it.
I believe that the person here in Michigan that just lost his job isn't suffering from a mental recession. I believe the mother here in Michigan, around America, who is trying to get enough money to educate their children, isn't whining.
Well, I'm sure glad that's settled. Whinomics on the campaign trail. Mental recessions. Does the Fed need Prozac? Or does the McCain campaign need a Grahamectomy? The doctor will see you now. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, July 11th. Mental recessions and recession-proof. Perhaps there's a connection. A market assessment at the end of the week. California still burning. An historic apology from the American Medical Association. And the new Apple iPhone. Someone else had the idea first, long ago. All those stories and more starts now. It's widely expected the International Criminal Court will charge Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir next week for war crimes in Darfur. Now UN officials are worried about violent political fallout. The BBC's Laura Trevelyan.
Officials fear the peacekeeping force in Darfur may be attacked in retaliation, and there's concern that the rebel groups will be emboldened because they see President al-Bashir as weakened.
Sudan has refused to recognize the International Criminal Court or honor requests to turn over a government minister and militia leader previously charged with war crimes. The bodies of two U.S. soldiers missing in Iraq since May of last year have been found. Relatives of Army Sergeant Alex Jimenez of Lawrence, Massachusetts, and Private Byron Foti of Waterford, Michigan, say they've been notified by the Pentagon. Foti's stepfather, Gordon Dibbler.
Their lives were taken by people that didn't respect freedom at all. You know, we're saddened by that, of course. Our hearts are broken.
The two GIs were kidnapped during an ambush 14 months ago.
The Zimbabwe government and the opposition party are holding talks in South Africa. This follows a chaotic presidential election marred by violence, alleged threats, and ending with the uncontested re-election of President Mugabe. Turkey's prime minister visited Baghdad yesterday. He's only the second foreign head of a neighboring country to visit Iraq since the American invasion in 2003. Kuwait has also announced it will name its first ambassador to Iraq since 1990.
The Senate has approved the appointment of General David Petraeus as the head of U.S. Central Command, the military headquarters of the Middle East. Lieutenant General Raymond O'Donnell will replace General Petraeus as the chief military commander in Iraq.
Apple's upgraded iPhone goes on sale today in 21 countries, and people are lining up around the world to get the 3G phone. A lower price and faster web connections are key selling points. Barack Obama holds a town hall meeting in Dayton, Ohio this morning. We'll be talking about energy. John McCain is in Hudson, Wisconsin. Oil holding steady in Asian trading, and the S&P begins trading at 1253. We've got a lot to talk about today. What web TV or web television series do you watch? And early adopters, we talked about the iPhone a moment ago. What about really early adopters? Is there some technology that you bought way too early, maybe, and it didn't go anywhere? You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Also, who needs, you're talking
it's
about the AMA's apology,
it's good to
right?
Think ahead, though.
Who needs to apologize? That's another one.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. All whining aside, the real economy does have some issues worth discussing this morning. It's been quite a week. There have been mixed signals on the employment front and the retail front. But the big story this morning is really the state of the largest issuers of mortgages to most middle-class Americans, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. You may or may not have noticed, but their stock value has lost 80% of its value over the last several weeks. 17-year lows for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and the financial sector is struggling to assure investors that the two mortgage issuers are not on the verge of bankruptcy. Joining us now is Gretchen Morgenson, who's assistant business and financial editor of The New York Times and author of the New York Times Market Watch column. Gretchen, thanks for being with us.
Anytime.
Let's begin with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. First of all, what do they need? And broadly, what reassurance do investors need that they're actually not headed for some sort of catastrophic failure, which, of course, would ripple through the financial sector?
Well, you have to first understand that these are companies that are sort of quasi-governmental. They're part private and part, government-based. They are very important, in fact, crucial to the mortgage lending industry. They are the ones that finance a lot of home mortgages. So I think they have almost $6 trillion in mortgages that they are, either guaranteeing or financing. It is therefore really, really important that they continue to operate. Unfortunately, they have been operating with a very, very thin amount of capital, as a sort of cushion, as a rainy day fund almost, in case there are failures or problems with the mortgages that they've financed. And it's become clear that that capital has to increase.
And part of the reason for that is that the mortgages that they hold, which they often or partly offer as collateral or sort of put on the asset side of their balance sheet, are declining in value for the same reason that property values are declining in value, right?
Well, exactly. They are having some of the same problems that you've read about for now over a year in the rest of the financial sector. The banks have been writing off mortgage losses like crazy. Mortgage lenders have been going out of business right and left. So, it's not a surprise that they would be having some of the same problems. What seemed to have racked investors this week is the sudden realization that these companies need a ton more capital than they have, and as their stocks are plunging, that means that the existing shareholders are going to have their stakes diluted massively, meaning that your holding is going to be divvied up much more because new investors are going to have to come in and put more money in. So,
weeks ago, we saw how decisively Ben Bernanke came in and rescued the investment banking sector that was stuck with the subprime problems, even though Bear Stearns went down. The opening of the discount window to investment banks seemed to solve that problem for now. Speaking yesterday, Ben Bernanke addressed the issue of what to do about Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae.
Strong holding company oversight is essential, and thus, in my view, the Congress should consider requiring consolidated supervision of those firms and providing the regulator the authority to set standards for capital, liquidity holdings, and risk management.
Now, that sounds much more opaque and difficult to understand, rescuing Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, than the investment bank problem was.
Well, the problem is that, they have had a regulator all these years, and the regulator has been unwilling to regulate. I think that is probably the most distressing thing that investors have learned in this entire disaster, and that is that the regulators are really asleep at the switch throughout this this whole period. The mortgage lending boom was just allowed to go on. People were given loans that they should never have had, 100% financing, even more. It's really just been a very disturbing period for those who believe that capitalism is a very good system, but it needs to be regulated as well.
Gretchen, on the consumer level, who should be most worried? Those who hold a mortgage right now from Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, or those who are looking to get a mortgage from either one of the companies?
I think that the immediate impact of this is going to be felt most on the shareholders of the companies, but also on those people who are looking to finance a home, as you say, to get a mortgage. Those who already have a mortgage with Fannie Mae are really not at all imperiled. I think, though, that the problems of these companies are going to have a very big ripple effect across the entire home mortgage industry. So, because they've really been the only game in town since this problem really blew onto center stage.
Well, Gretchen, we've got to go, but I just want to ask you one thing. Are you one of the whiners Phil Graham is talking about? Is it you? Is it really you, Gretchen?
There are a lot of people who would say that, but listen, I'm just trying to be a truth teller here.
Gretchen Morgenson, Assistant Business and Financial Editor of the New York Times and author of the New York Times Market Watch column. Adora?
We're going to call her Gretchen the Truth Teller.
Truth Teller.
Morgenson.
Yeah.
There we go. We're going to head off to California, where the flames are still crackling in Butte County in Northern California. There's just simply been no let-up for 2 weeks. 1,700 wildfires have taken out nearly 100 homes, forced tens of thousands to flee, and for the first time in the state's history, put National Guard troops on the ground. Today, the city of Paradise is in a precarious position, already reeling from the destruction of homes last month in a separate fire. Now, again, thousands of homes are at risk. On the line, we have Yoshpe White, an engineer with Cal Fire in Northern California. Now, you've been on the front line since early June. How are you holding up?
I got to tell you, it's long days, and there's been a lot of them. I, along with most of the folks that I've been working here, have been on duty since around the 10th or so of June.
And we're talking about 90,000 firefighters at this point.
That's true. Throughout the state, over 1,000 fires on that one day, June 21st alone, due to lightning.
Now, the people of Paradise City, boy, they're really sitting on the brink at the moment. You've been there. Can you describe to us what's happening?
Well, historically, down that Feather River Canyon, we have very, very strong winds in the middle of the night. Several fires in the past few years, in 2000 and 2001, are the last times I was over here before I actually worked here. In the middle of the night, fire in the canyon gets blown down into that community of Concow. This time, what it's done that it hasn't done in the past is it blew all the way down to the west branch of the Feather River. Now, that's a drainage that separates the community known as Concow from the town of Paradise. So right now, the fire is back down along that water drainage, and we do have immediate threat evacuations in Paradise as a precaution in case that fire were to cross over the drainage.
Yoshpe, why is it so difficult to put out these darn fires?
Mother Nature is our number one enemy, it seems like, the last few weeks. Just when we seem to have a handle on a lot of these fires, the wind will do something else. The humidities will come down to bone dry in the teens, low teens. The winds come up and the heat goes up. And that combination is a recipe for disaster.
I can only imagine the frustration for you firefighters, but what about the people that you've had to evacuate and re-evacuate and just gone back and forth, basically like a seesaw?
I tell you, my heart goes out to those folks. I haven't been in that position, and I don't care to be. And I feel for them having to be, like you say, evacuated multiple times. And then just when we think, you know, we let them back in and everything seems to be okay, we get a wind change and a fire that wasn't even in their area comes barreling down that canyon and destroys 50 buildings in that community, Concow.
And some of these stories must be very sad. Speaking of Concow, let's just take a listen to one person.
As they were leaving the fire, their animals were chasing them, trying to keep up, and there's a lot of people who just don't know if their pets even made it out.
That sounds incredibly sad as people are fleeing. They don't even know if their pets are making it or whether they're with them. What kind of stories have you come across?
You know, that is really heart-wrenching. You know, people all over the world, your pets are become your family members. We have a great organization here in Butte County known as the North Valley Animal Disaster Group. They were formed for just this occasion. And when people evacuate, they come in and they will evacuate your animals, large and small. I came across a building, a home, 2 days ago when the fire did blow up. I came across a home that was beginning to be involved with fire, and we thought that there might have been a person in the home. We made entry into the home through a rear door.
Was
the
there
of the building.
A person?
There wasn't, but I did find a chihuahua. And,
you did find a dog. Luckily, so far, there has been very few casualties and injuries in this fire and during this period of fire. Yoshpe White, engineer with CAL FIRE in Northern California, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And a chihuahua saver. He's a hero.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253. Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. News just within the last few minutes. Oil is spiking because of concerns about instability in Nigeria. It's up more than $3 a barrel. And also, the markets seem to be rattled by that. The Wall Street is set to open lower this morning, at least according to the futures. Bob on our website says, free markets away, savings and loan, junk bonds, web IPOs, Enron mortgages, regulators. We don't need no stinking regulators, referring to my interview with Gretchen Morgenson just a moment ago. Take away questions today. What technology did you buy too early? Thinking about the iPhone that goes on sale today. What did you get too early that didn't quite make it? Were you a Betacam buyer? Were you a Betamax buyer? Also, who needs to apologize? And that relates to a story that's coming up next.
We are talking about an apology. It's a new day at the American Medical Association. Yesterday, the association issued an historic apology to black physicians who for decades were actively excluded and forbidden to participate in the American Medical Association. Though the organization was founded in 1847, it wasn't until 1964, just over 40 years ago, that they allowed blacks to become more than half members. Dr. George C. Debnam, a trustee at Shaw University and a general practitioner who practiced for 50 years, joins us now. Good morning and welcome, Dr. Debnam.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well, sir. And take us back to 1955 when you were a young doctor. What did the AMA offer you?
In 1955, they offered a scientific membership. Which excluded all social activities. That included dinners, dances. It included anything other than a scientific discussion of a disease, especially a lecture. That was only the lecture, the scientific part of it. All the other aspects of it was excluded from us.
So you were seeing patients, you were treating patients, you were being a doctor, committed to your profession, but you weren't allowed to participate in those kinds of discussions with other doctors. How did that make you feel?
Well, of course, my society, which in 1895, because of the exclusion, the black doctors developed their own medical society in 1895. And, of course, we had a chapter of that where I practiced and in the state of North Carolina, state organization. And, of course, it decided that if we weren't going to receive full representation, we weren't going to receive full membership, that we didn't want at that particular time to get a halfway membership or that type of thing. So we voted not to accept that and to wait until they were able to offer us a full membership.
Now, two of your friends, one of them who was actually your fraternity brother, they chose to join. Why didn't you take that scientific membership from the AMA?
The organization had voted not to accept that, and our organization was very, very strong on that. We had a large number of doctors in North Carolina, and they felt that that was not the correct way to go about in 1955. This was not the best way to go about Mexican equality, quality care, to take care of our patients. We decided that was not a proper mode of membership, and therefore I, of course, went along with my organization.
With the National Medical Association. So let's come back to today. The American Medical Association is now apologizing. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it is very, very wonderful that they are doing this. They are very, very late on this. They are late, but it's better late than never. And we appreciate so much that they are doing that now. Now, keep in mind, I was here in North Carolina. That was a little different than people in Mississippi and Georgia, other places. We had five good black hospitals here in North Carolina. So I always was able to practice in a hospital alongside with doctors, white doctors.
Oh, that's interesting.
But was in a segregated black hospital with not enough facilities in order to take care of what the hospital across town who took care only white patients took care of.
Dr. Denham, let me ask you this. You have two daughters who are now doctors. It's become a family business. What do you think this apology means for them and their careers?
Well, it means a great deal for them because they, too, are old enough to realize what segregation. We both went to the same medical school in Nashville, Tennessee, which was predominantly, at the time they went, of course, you know, after the 60s.
You're talking about Meharry.
That's correct. Right, that's right. Things had begun to break open a little bit because, see, in 1964, the government, began to, under President Lyndon B. Johnson, they began to withhold money from those hospitals and things that still excluded the black physicians. So that's why the AMA accepted us into it. Except to start with, was under federal pressure. I can remember here in Raleigh, two men came from Washington, D.C., and did not let the all-white hospital get its Medicaid and Medicare.
So it began as a forced integration, and today the American Medical Association is taking it upon themselves. Dr. Debnam, retired general practitioner. Sir, thanks so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you so very much.
He's one magnanimous guy.
He really is.
He rejects that degrading scientific membership, but he accepts the apology. I would have just told the AMA to just shove it.
We're going to get some headlines, and we're going to be really nice to Femi Okeh now because it's her turn. Femi?
Hello there. It is just gone 28 minutes past the hour. The bodies of two U.S. soldiers missing in Iraq for more than a year have been recovered. As the IRS mails out the last of the economic stimulus checks today, President Bush meets with his economic team. And California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger is asking for more federal resources to fight wildfires across his state. Talks between the government in Zimbabwe and the opposition party are taking place in South Africa. They follow a chaotic presidential election marred by violence and ending with the uncontested re-election of President Mugabe last month. Opposition spokesperson Handel Mulilo says there are preconditions that have to be met.
The violence must cease. These militias, these thugs that are all over the country must be disbanded, and these people that are doing all of these things sent back to their homes.
The UN Security Council has delayed voting on a package of sanctions against Zimbabwe. 67 residents from a neighborhood near Zanesville, Ohio, will be getting nearly $11 million after a federal jury found that they were denied a public water service for decades because of their race. The lines were laid in 1956, but they weren't hooked up until 2003. Goodness me, I will never complain about my utilities again. Later on, I will bring you the story about what's off the menu in Beijing in the Olympics. I'll give you a clue.
And thanks, Femi. Also, oil is up more
than
$3.
Is that a duck or a dog?
It's a dog, actually.
Okay.
We've got to have duck in the Beijing Olympics, but dog, maybe not.
Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its American Worker Initiative. More at rockfound.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Father's Day, a short film about a woman whose father left her when she was a child, and her daughter, who now wants to meet her estranged grandfather, if he lives long enough. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. Once upon a time, there was just the silver screen. But now there's the big screen, and there's the small screen, and there's the big screen TV, and then there's the itty-bitty web screen, where TV, the entire TV industry, seems to be migrating. Culture critic Mary Beth Williams is here. Is that true? Well, the little itty-bitty screen?
Don't forget about the little screen. Don't forget about your phone. You can watch stuff on your phone,
That's
too.
That's the itty-bitty-bitty-bitty screen.
That's teeny-weeny. Well, here's what I was thinking. I mean, not that being on early morning public radio isn't the gravy train we'd all dreamed that it would be,
Ooh,
guys.
Be careful. But, Mary Beth,
you found out.
Remember, you are a guest here.
You found out.
But I've been thinking, guys, maybe it's time we all start making good on the dream that we've had since 1994. Maybe we start figuring out how to really make some money here on the internet.
Selling screenplays?
Well, I was thinking about it. You know, first I came up with maybe it's porn, maybe it's cats, maybe it's the Nigerian royal family, but I think maybe here's what it's going to be. How about an action, adventure, musical, sing-along blog? What do you think so far?
Action,
what do you think?
Well, hold on. Action, wait, adventure,
musical, sing-along, blog, and maybe
sing-along.
And maybe we get Doogie Howser to star in it. Are you with me so far?
I think it's good. You lost me at Doogie Howser.
No.
You lost me at the sing-along and action.
Think about it. Think about that. That could be a concept. You don't like that? Okay, how about this? How about we get little tiny, like, two-minute cartoon slash ads, and we make them about funny stuff like mad cow disease, and we make money like that. What do you think of that? Can we do that?
Is mad cow disease funny? Not in South Korea. It's not funny.
Riot, we could try that. Or what about if we do...
South Korea is funny. Mad cow disease is not.
Is not? Is that the,
yeah,
is that the litmus test?
Yeah.
Okay, how about scripted comedy starring two-year-olds pretending to be drunk and verbally abusive.
I love that idea.
Maybe that's
the one. Hit. But all these are real.
Oh, it's all real.
Now, explain what's going on in the business and why these pitches are not just sort of dismissed out of hand.
The main reason is because you actually have some big-name talent attached to it, and you're actually starting to get some big-name money attached to it.
And these are episodic web series.
We call them webisodes.
Webisodes.
Sean.
Yeah. And Webovision.
And Weborama.
Well, let's hear an example. And I've just heard this, but I don't know much about it. You can
maybe
explain it to
some action-adventure comedy?
Here we go.
For every day, there is a night. For every world, there is an underworld. And for every hero, there's this guy.
What do you think? What do you think? That's Doogie. That's Neil Patrick Harris there. He is Dr. Horrible, and that is premiering next week on drhorrible.com. It is a three-part original web musical created by Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Firefly creator Joss Whedon.
It's the
How
sing-along,
long is it?
Sing-along blog.
It's a sing-along. It's real.
Oh, my God.
It's for reals, and it's deep, and it's going down next week. Yeah, and that is, it's going to be three parts, 15 minutes each, roughly, premiering next week, and then it's going to limit time, and then it's going to disappear, and then they hope it will be available for download, and people will actually pay for it. Pay for the downloads because they liked it so
What's
very
What's the premise of the actual, like, you gave us the umbrella description, but what is it about exactly?
It's about a nerdy guy who has a crush on a pretty girl and decides to become a supervillain at the Evil League of Evil. And that's how we're all going to make money on the internet now.
Because she rejects him?
Because he wants to impress her with his evil ways. And it's going to be great. And people who were big Buffy fans, as I was, probably remember.
I really like Buffy.
And the musical episode was fantastic. And this is something Joss Whedon has said he wanted to do for a long time ever since. And so he and his brothers, during the writer's strike last spring, said, well, let's just get off our butts and make something new and interesting during this time.
How are they going to make money?
They're going to that's the billion-dollar question. They're going to try and do it through downloads and distribution and hope that the goodwill that they've created with their incredibly loyal, devoted fans will actually pay off. But then we have other people who are getting the money up front and are getting really huge, huge money. And that's what's kind of also interesting as well.
Well, before we talk about the huge money, I mean, it seems to me the writer strike created a bit of a renaissance here in that a lot of these writers got, comedy performers got what they don't get in the studio world, and that is autonomy. Here's our good friend, America's good friend, Will Ferrell, with something that's actually a bit of an oldie on the web. It's a classic oldie, but it's only about a year old.
2007.
Here we go.
Hi, Pearl.
What happened?
You don't have to raise your voice.
You pay you!
I can give you half.
You pay you!
Hey, don't talk to me like that, okay?
I'm this crap.
Look, I thought I was clear in my email that I needed a couple weeks.
I worked too hard.
Can I just get 2 more weeks?
I want my money.
You need to relax.
Like, as a mother myself, nothing is better than a verbally abusive toddler. That is just as good as it gets. That's Funny or Die, which started about a year and a half ago, Will Ferrell and his friend Adam McKay. But again, the writer's strike really created this influx onto the site of other performers, writers, comedians, people like Judd Apatow, putting up original content there. And that is changing the web. People are saying, you know what, here's a place where we can go. I want to get over to this other big deal that's happening, saying here's where we can go and we can say the things we want to say and we can create things the way we want to create them and maybe even make truckloads and truckloads of money.
So quickly before we go, who's got the huge upfront money here?
It's Seth MacFarlane, creator of Family Guy. He just got the biggest deal ever for original web content.
Man can do no wrong.
He's got the cavalcade, his cavalcade of cartoon comedy coming in September.
Really?
It's being funded through Google AdSense, Media Rights Capital, and he's going to make a lot.
Wow.
It's going to be the highest paid.
I, however, can do wrong if I don't get to Femi.
We'll get to Femi
over here. So, Mary Beth, sit tight there. We'll be right back. The tiny little screen. What TV do you watch on the web? You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And now, headlines from our own Femi. Okay.
Thanks, John. 20 minutes to the hour. For the first time in more than 30 years, National Guard troops are on the ground in California helping to battle the wildfires. In Afghanistan, investigators say a U.S. airstrike last Sunday killed 39 women and children. UN officials fear that reprisals on peacekeepers in Sudan amid speculation that the president may be charged with war crimes. And official restaurants at the Beijing Olympics are taking dog meat off the menu. I want to take you back to 1969. John Lennon is in a bed-in protest in Montreal in Canada. Question is, how much is peace worth? When he sat in the bed, he wrote the lyrics to Give Peace a Chance. He wrote them down on a piece of paper. Those lyrics went up for sale yesterday, and they came in for $833,000.
Oh, my goodness. They were only supposed to get $400,000.
Twice as much as
and
estimated.
And the crowd gasps.
That's
spectacular,
amazing. That is spectacular.
Yeah.
John Lennon, he told Gail Renard, the woman who owned those lyrics, right? Mm-hmm. This might be worth something someday.
He was absolutely right. $833,000.
Peace gets a chance on The Takeaway. Thanks, Emmy.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji.
They're going to take out all our phones and put in them kind with dials on them. As soon as a man gets used to one thing, by golly, somebody wants to take it away from him.
By golly, if you've gotten used to your cell phone, you're going to maybe have to toss it into the landfill because the new iPhone goes on sale today. If it generates half the hype that the original iPhone did, then lines will be snaking around the block and then some. But, you know, the iPhone is just the most recent example of something that's been going on for quite a long time, and telephones have been the center of changing technology. Long before the iPhone, the humble ancestor of a phone that had a picture on it, the iPhone, of course, does lots more than just a picture, was the 1964 AT&T picture phone. Okay, you may have heard about this. You may have seen it in science fiction movies. But this modern marvel was the first serious attempt to market a video phone as a consumer good. People were impressed by the technology, but the picture phone was a disaster. It was too costly. The controls were too confusing. The picture too small. At least those were the reviews. Only 150 of the original units were made. And the inventor, Daniel Henderson, owns one of them. Dan, you got number 117, right?
Yeah, that's right.
That's beautiful. So you invented the picture phone.
Well,
you helped.
The picture phone in 1964 was not my work, but it was certainly the earliest commercial version of sending pictures over a telephone line. One of the earliest, yeah.
And, you know, the picture phone was a great idea that everybody sort of got back in the 60s, but it was really difficult to create enough of a network so that people would actually use them, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
And so they were a bit of a disaster. What happened?
Well, you know, I think it wasn't until people realized later that we were becoming more and more mobile, that the need for sending information to a wireless device became apparent. And that was when I developed the Intellect wireless device in 1993.
So you were ahead on pictures and ahead on wireless phones, right?
Yes.
What do you think it takes for a revolutionary piece of technology that involves consumers to actually have legs and take, you know what I mean? Actually stick.
Well, that's a question that product designers have been, like me, have been trying to answer for a long time. I think, you know, I've heard some people say that it should be something that feels like magic. And in a large sense, the wireless devices that we're seeing now have become the remote control to the world around us. And as we move around more and more, I think the ability to access information while we're on the go has seemed somewhat magical.
Daniel Henderson, it's got to feel like magic. You know, I think that's a great sort of, you know, credo to take with us as we go out and figure out who's going to be buying iPhones. Daniel, thanks for joining us. Are you buying an iPhone, Mary Beth?
I am. I'm not going to be lining up this morning. It's not Def Leppard tickets. I have my priorities straight, but I will definitely be getting the new one. I love my current one.
Def Leppard,
I'd be there. I wouldn't be here
right
now. That's all I'm saying.
Does it feel like magic, though?
It feels like magic, and then it gets boring.
It feels like magic, and then it gets boring. Like
like everything else.
My dates when I was a teenager.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
So what TV do you watch on the web? Good morning, everybody. And what technology did you buy way too early, thinking about the iPhone and the picture phone that we were talking about just a moment ago? Also, are you a whiner? We are supposedly a nation of whiners, according to John McCain's economic advisor, Phil Graham, former Texas Senator Phil Graham. We wanted to focus on the actual economy today rather than the impressions of politicians. And the signs aren't really positive this morning. Oil is spiking once again. It looks like the markets are going to be down. Volatility related to geopolitical instability in places like Nigeria, where a lot of oil comes from. But we thought we would look at some counter indicators of the economy today. If there are recessionary indicators in the economy, what are recession-proof sectors in the economy? And do they get activated when economic downturns begin to persist and trend severely downward? Cheryl Einhorn joins us. She's adjunct professor at Columbia University of Business, and she's an economic and financial journalist. And Cheryl, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
You know, I was thinking one of the things that probably does have an activity uptick in a recessionary environment are things like pawn shops. Guys, can we get a pawn shop owner on the phone? Because I want to ask what's going on with pawn shops in times of recession. Okay, Dylan, will you handle that for me? All right, we'll get to that in just a second. But Cheryl, what are recession-proof industries? What are recession-proof sectors?
Well, first of all, I don't think anything is recession-proof. Some sectors of the economy certainly
do better in an economic downturn and therefore are counter-cyclical. And pawn shops that you mentioned, I think it's a terrific example.
We'll find out.
Right. The share prices I looked up of some of the publicly traded pawnbroker companies, and they've done very nicely. So, for instance, Cash America Corp, their share price is up about 18% this year. It was up $3 yesterday. And Easy Corp, its share price is up 42% this year.
That's interesting.
And First Cast Financial is up 12%. And I think it's because, you know, it's difficult for people to borrow money right now.
So many companies would love to see those percentage hikes.
The recession-proof example that always comes to mind for me, and we were talking about this earlier, is the Hollywood movie industry really came alive during the 1930s. In the midst of the Depression, everybody went to the movies, and it kind of created the Hollywood that we know today in some sense.
You know, I think that's exactly right. You know, the down and out absolutely wanted some type of a diversion, and you were right. Theater ticket sales went way up, and I think that's why some people have been talking about what's happening with video game producers, you know, that video games have held up pretty well. And, you know, it's more expensive, obviously, than buying a movie ticket. A movie ticket is $10 and you go once. If you are buying a video game, you're spending $50, $60 on the video game, and then you need something.
50 or 60 hours a week on the video game.
Right,
possibly.
And you need something to play it on as well. But certainly those sales have held up well, and I think it's because, just as you're saying, people want some form of entertainment or some sort of diversion.
Or comfort. John, I have ESP right now because I know exactly what he's going to say, but I bring up an authentic example, which is the pet supply industry. When you take a look at their numbers for not only pet supplies, that businesses are expected to rise at least 6% this year, but veterinary care up $1 billion from $10 billion last year to $11 billion this year. There is this expectation that when people are stressed, they spend more money and time taking care of their pets.
Well, I think, you know, pet sales have just done terrific. Just as you said, people really want to take care of them. The other sectors, we're talking about retail sales, which came out yesterday for an awful lot of companies, stores that have moderately priced clothing, like the Children's Place, have done well. People are also, you know, continuing to spend money on their kids, so kids and pets.
You know, the healthcare industry in general always does well in recessionary times. And even though it's good for the healthcare sector, it doesn't ripple through the economy very much at all. Healthcare doing well may be good for certain stock portfolios, but it isn't a broad indicator of prosperity for most Americans.
Well, I think, you know, healthcare, almost half of the 30 fastest growing fields are concentrated in health services. And, you know, if you're looking for areas where there may continue to be some job openings, certainly things like medical assistants and medical records and physical therapists, that continues to be a growth area in the economy.
So as far as Phil Graham is concerned, these sectors that we've been talking about, these people are not whining. These people are definitely not having a mental recession. They're doing all right.
Well, I think they're certainly doing better than other major sectors of the economy. You would much rather, you know, be looking at a career in healthcare than you would be trying to go into the auto sector now.
Do we have the pawn shop owner?
We do, and it's funny that you should ask, because we did find Annette Hoag. She and her husband run Annette's North Stockton Jewelry and Loan in Stockton, California, which 60 Minutes says Annette is the foreclosure capital of America. Have you been busy lately?
We've been extremely busy. business is up quite a bit from last year.
And what kinds of things are people coming into your store with? Are they selling their family heirlooms?
Well, most people are pawning them, which means they can redeem them and get them back. But we've seen about a 37% increase in the first 6 months of this year.
And are they redeeming them?
Well, most people are extending their loans. They're not redeeming them, but they're not losing them.
What kinds of things are people selling? Give us an example of a story of someone who's come in.
Well, most people, a lot of people are having a hard time because of the gasoline prices, and Stockton is centrally located, and we have a lot of commuters here. So people are bringing in things they don't need necessarily, like their high-end wristwatches or diamond rings that are not necessary for them to survive on, and they're pawning these type items.
Is it a real emotional venture? I mean, are you finding that people are coming in desperate for money?
Well, they're not having an easy time.
Are you finding, Annette, that given that gold prices are so high right now, you know, about $900 an ounce, and that people are looking to actually see if they can take advantage of that?
I think some people are. Some people are definitely selling now because the prices are so much better than they've been in the last couple of years. But a lot of people are just pawning things to help make them through their mortgage payments and the gasoline prices.
Quickly, Annette, because we've got to go, but what can't you pawn? If I'm thinking of pawning something, you know, tell me to forget it.
Your animals, your children.
Children.
Do people try that?
Anything. Well, we had one person try to pawn a snake, but we don't take animals. If it eats, we don't take it.
Good call, Annette. Annette Hoag, thank you very much.
You're more than welcome.
Okay, good job, guys. Thanks for doing that. So, Cheryl, you want to take us out? I mean, that's a real example of exactly what you were talking about.
I think so. I think the other thing to point out is that when you're borrowing from a pawnbroker, the rates are so much higher than borrowing on your credit card. You know, sometimes the rates can be several hundred dollars as a percentage. And, you know, so it's so much more expensive. And I think it really shows that since this industry is doing so well, that people are just not finding access to credit in the traditional places that they've been able to borrow in the past.
So recession-proof is maybe a misnomer. It's increased activity because of economic downturn. It's not necessarily a happy sign, even though it may mean short-term prosperity for individuals. Cheryl, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Cheryl Einhorn is adjunct professor at Columbia University of Business, Economic and Financial Journalism. Thank you, Cheryl. Keep your responses coming to anything you heard on today's show. Send us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE. No, we don't take snakes either. We're talking about pawn shops, Winomics on the campaign trail, mental recessions, historic apologies, and who really should apologize.
Hey, John.
Yeah.
You said that really well.
Oh, thank you.
Increased activity, not recession-proof. That may be one of the takeaways, but here's another takeaway from this hour.
First I came up with maybe it's porn, maybe it's cats, maybe it's the Nigerian royal family.
Thank you.
I'm a member of the Nigerian royal family.
That's right.
Did you know that?
I did notice, and you didn't jump in there. I thought that was extraordinary restraint on your part. And don't get used to those cats and the Nigerian family too quickly, because...
As soon as a man gets used to one thing, by golly, somebody wants to take it away from him.
And you know, we're not going to take anything away from you. But we want to know whether you are going to play the Beep Stakes game. That's on our presidential running mate stock trading game on Facebook. It's your chance to predict and trade possible VP candidates for Barack Obama and John McCain.
Yeah, and it's going wild. This morning, Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman's stock price is down about 44% from yesterday. Lots of players are seizing the opportunity to buy. Lieberman's jumped to number 2 on John McCain's Veep Stakes list. In first place, though, Alaskan Governor Sarah Palin.
She's been doing really well. On the Democrat side, Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius, she's been doing well, as has retired General Wesley Clark. They've been duking it out all week, back and forth. But for a third day, Kathleen Sebelius is winning.
So we'll keep playing along with you and offering Veep Stakes stock tips. You can join us on Facebook. Also, don't forget the Heroes Reports that's also on our website. If you see something, say something, especially if it's good news. We're creating a map of good karma in America and in the city of New York.
Yeah, we like good karma.
Yeah, we do.
Especially on the weekends.
Especially on a Friday.
Yes, I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.